Manager will come to order. And good morning, everyone. In attendance today, I'd like to thank Sheriff Ramirez for joining us today.
Good morning.
Thank you. And Commissioner Mark Garber for joining us today. Mark, thank
you.
We will have others joining us here in just a few minutes. I think at this time we will... Let me ask you, Marjorie, any announcements we need to make prior to going?
Really not at this time.
Okay, sounds good. I will open a public hearing on proposal number 026. Dave Henderson, from call.
Chair Wilson and members of the committee, I'm Dave Henderson, Legislative Administrator. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. If it suits the members of the committee, I think perhaps the best approach on this would be there's about half a dozen bullet items on proposal number 26, and if you'd like, we can just run down those bullet items and chat briefly about each one and be ready to respond to any questions you might have.
That sounds great. I think the thing that we want to do today is let you run with this, and unlike confirmation hearing back east, we'll let you refuse to answer certain questions. The subject today is security, and obviously we don't want to compromise security by any questions we ask. So we just want a general overview today, really starting with who's responsible for security here and any points that you would like to share with us. And if the committee feels that any stone needs to be turned over after this, we can obviously go into executive session if we need to on a sensitive issue. But with that said, let's go ahead and let you run with security issues.
We appreciate your understanding, Chair, and I would like to acknowledge right up front the excellent support we've gotten from Sheriff Ramirez's office. They conducted a thorough security audit for us over the course of the last year or so, and they did that at our request and were extremely supportive. We've also had great support out of the Oregon State Police, who are here in the building, and we'll go into a little bit more detail about that, but I would just like to acknowledge Sheriff Ramirez's office for all that they've done for us. The first item is about background checks and badges for members, staff, and lobbyists. Just so that you will know, here is the access badge, which is issued to all employees in the building, including all elected officials, legislators, governor, secretary of state, treasurer. These were implemented in the last few years following the 9/11 incidents that took place. We've conducted several audits of security in the building since that time. U.S. Secret Service came in and did an audit for us. As I said, the Sheriff's Office came in following the incident that occurred at the early on in the 2005 session when the man bolted into the Senate chamber with a knife. So the Sheriff's Office has done an audit for us, and the Oregon State Police have audited the security in the building as well. As far as background checks, we researched this thoroughly shortly after 9/11 and came up with some estimates on the cost of conducting background checks. There are problems or there are issues related to background checks. How widely do you check? Do you check just in Oregon? Do you check Northwest states? Do you check nationwide? And the cost obviously increases depending on how broadly you do background checks. At this point, we have not implemented any program to conduct them. Other issues that would have to be decided would be on whom would you conduct background checks? Would it be everyone coming into the building or everyone wanting to have an access badge, or would it be only those people who had, say, access to offices other than their own? Would it be people who are handling money, things of that nature? Beyond that, what would you be checking for? Would you be checking for crimes against property, crimes against people? There are so many different variables related to background checks that at this point we have made the decision that it would not be cost effective to do that. We're obviously open to changing that. We have a request right now from the Capital Club, which is the professional association of lobbyists here in the building, to have access badges during the next legislative session. And it is our inclination, as they are tenants in the building, to grant them those access badges. But we're working out right now whether that would entail doing background checks on them or not. At this point, I would say it's not likely that we will do them, but it is certainly something that we're open to doing further research on and reporting back on. Right now, what we have done following the 9/11 incidents is we have limited access to certain doors in the building. You will recall that at one point all of the, I think there are, if I remember right, seven different access doors. Following 9/11, we closed access to the doors at the end of each of the wings and the door coming into the old building on the west side of the building. The reason that we did that, and I'm this is covering actually a couple of these bullets. The reason we did that is that it's easier to monitor access if you limit the number of doors that people are coming in through. This was recommended in the Secret Service audit, the Sheriff's audit, the State Police audit. They have all been very supportive of that concept. So right now we have public access through the center doors on State Street, the revolving doors on Court Street, and the handicap accessible door at the east end of the building. We have card-keyed access at the other doors, so employees in the building are able to come in through the other doors. We have also granted card key access to some members in the executive branch who are frequent visitors to the Capitol. And our goal here is not to make it difficult to get into the building for the person who is here on a regular basis conducting business. We do require that any of those folks who are not employed in the building who have asked for access badges that they have the approval of their supervisor before we'll grant those badges. We have also issued a small number of badges to folks who are not actually state employees, but because of disability issues, it's easier for them to come into the building through the tunnel, and that is card-keyed as well, but that's a fairly limited number of cards that have been issued there. That's a very broad and very high-level discussion of the access badges. We, as I said, we do monitor through surveillance cameras. This is not any secret. The public access doors, and we do have somebody monitoring those the entire time that the building is open. So that should someone enter the building who appears suspicious in any way, we immediately notify the state police. They dispatch an officer to go and intercept that person and just frankly have a conversation with them if they have any reason to believe that they may be here for any reason that would not be just conducting normal business here.
Fine. Good. Any questions from the...
Yes.
Commissioner Wilhelms.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. He gave back on the question of background checks. I'm recalling from my former life, we passed a bill somewhere back in the 80s, I think. It was called the Criminal Records Check Bill. And it gave employers the ability to check through the state police criminal records, potential criminal records, of any person that they were thinking about hiring. I don't even know what the status of that law might be today, but I don't think it's ever been changed, and I think you can still do that. I think private employers can. I'm curious as to why the state wouldn't do the same thing. Why the legislative branch wouldn't do the same thing. Because it wasn't very expensive. And it may not have been a nationwide check. It was a check of the records that the Oregon State Police had at the time, available to them. But it was a fairly simple thing. And as I recall, not very expensive. I don't know what's happened over the last 20 years or 15 years, whatever it's been, to the price. But it seemed to me like a criminal records check on a potential employee would be routine.
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Wilhelms, certainly it's something that we could do. I would have to research the statute to see, but I believe that we have the authority to do that. We've not established any protocols for what we would do if we found something.
Hire them.
Commissioner Wilhelms, that could become somewhat problematic because the number of people who are hired here during the legislative session, would we want to conduct background checks on all of those folks? And if they had a conviction at some point for some minor offense, what would we establish as the threshold at which they would not be hired? And we do have, at this point, during a session, at least 90 different appointing authorities, 30 senators and 60 representatives. And so it might be a slight political minefield through which we would be treading.
It wouldn't be the first time. But I'm dead serious about, you know, if somebody's got you named the offense, I don't know, but if it's a felony, I don't know why we would have any, why there would be any problem with just denying employment to a felon, convicted felon, who hadn't had their record expunged by that time. I mean, is that a civil rights problem? Or is that a discrimination problem? To say, if you're a convicted felon, no, we're not going to hire you in legislative administration or in the legislative branch of government.
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Wilhelms, I'm not aware that it would be any kind of civil rights issue. I think, again, it's a political issue, if you want to go there.
Well, I do, for the record.
Commissioner Ramirez.
If I could comment also, Dave, I really appreciate the work and leadership that you provided in looking at the security aspect, making this a safer place, not only for those that work here, but for the public that is coming into this facility. Going on Commissioner Wilhelms' comments with regards to backgrounds, I think what you need to take into consideration as you look at this particular arena is the fact that it allows the organization or agency to really screen individuals that could create situations in that environment. As an example, if you don't do a criminal check, you potentially could end up with a sexual predator being employed, and we have children, thousands of them, that come into this facility. That's just one example. If you don't screen for that, then you're not going to catch that. The other piece, and we certainly have found that in our application process, that individuals will apply for employment even though there's warrants of arrest for them, and even in law enforcement. So we've taken individuals into custody that have applied for a law enforcement position. And so I guess, you know, with that, think about where we need to be heading to really look at how do we protect the employees that are here and the public that accesses this facility.
Commissioner Ramirez, I wonder, if you do a background check for felony convictions, do you have a choice to do it state by state, nationwide? How can you get the biggest picture?
Well, right now, the easiest is, of course, within the state of Oregon. And on a background, in the application, the individual will list addresses if that's what's required for the last 10 years. So if those are out of states, then you would work with those particular jurisdictions. There is no such thing as a blanketed national screening. NCIC, though, if the individual is wanted, there's a warrant of arrest. But if you're looking at, you know, what kind of activity did the individual get involved in a particular state, you would have to query that particular state. But from the application, you'd be able to point you in that direction of where you need to pursue additional information.
If they give you a bogus application or just simply do not list all the places that they have lived, obviously that puts you in a disadvantageous position, correct?
Well, again, if in the background investigation that comes up that they've been deceptive, that's going to disqualify them at that point. So.
All right, thanks. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Wilhelms.
Dave, has there ever been an incident where we got into a problem with an employee in the legislative branch and then found out that the person did have a record that we could have accessed?
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Wilhelms, I believe we did have an incident in the last year where we had an employee who did have prior criminal record,
and then got
that employee's no longer with us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
But it
within the last
but
year.
But the departure had nothing to do with the prior criminal record.
Yeah, but if we had a rule that said if you have a record, you don't get hired, then the incident wouldn't happen.
Correct.
Commissioner Garber.
Yeah, I just had a comment and then a question. But on the criminal background check, I agree with Dave that you have to set up, within our company, which is a private company, we do those prior to hiring. But you get into tricky situations where you have someone who maybe had a felony 10 or 12 years ago and has had an exemplary life since then, and and you don't want to deny someone the opportunity to improve themselves over time. And so you do have to have some very well-defined guidelines in place before you go down that road. I don't necessarily have a problem with us recommending that we do that, but that it be part of a sort of an overall program that includes some guidelines, because it's not always cut and dry that you got a felony, you can't be hired. And the other question, which I'm sure you're probably going to get into in a little while, but when you talk about the audits that have been done by these various agencies, did any of them recommend metal detectors or that type of security at the public access points?
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Garber, yes, they have recommended that we put in metal detectors, and we actually did acquire two metal detectors about 2 years ago because we had the opportunity following the Olympic Games in Salt Lake City, where they had deployed obviously a large number of these. A number of agencies were able to purchase those at a very reduced price. So we did purchase those. We have two of them. They are in storage right now. We've tested them to ensure that they would work, and we could deploy them in a matter of a few hours should the decision be made to do that. We did develop a matrix for responding to potential threats following 9/11, which includes steps of implementing the metal detectors, actually closing off Court Street and State Street potentially, depending on the level of threat. And it's a graded system where as the threat increases, the response increases. And we do have that. That's kind of the protocol off of which we work. The issues that you run into with deploying metal detectors, one of the biggest ones is the cost, because you've obviously got to have people there to monitor the folks coming through the metal detectors. And whether you do that with uniformed state police officers or contracted officers, I believe that the county courthouse uses contract services, and that is something that we have looked into. The number of doors that you would have people come in through, bag screening, and the materials that you would need to do bag screening, and it becomes fairly expensive in short order.
Commissioner Burns.
I just wanted to clarify in that example that you provided a bit ago regarding the individual who was let go and later it was discovered that they had a criminal background. The reason they were let go had nothing to do with their criminal background, you said?
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Burns, I want to clarify that the employee was not let go. They resigned voluntarily.
Okay, so it was just...
And the departure had absolutely nothing to do with the prior criminal background.
So we don't have any examples of people who've worked in the Capitol and later discovered that they had criminal background and that criminal background caused problems for them or prevented them from being able to work within the Capitol or caused issues?
Commissioner Wilson, Chair, or Commissioner Burns, we've had... I can think of another instance where an employee was let go specifically because of being involved in some criminal activity. But again, it was not related to their employment here in the building.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we don't have a prior history of... I agree with this policy. I just want to make sure that we understand all the facts, that we haven't had problems in the past that would be solved by this. But we do realize it is good measure for us to have criminal background checks for our employment purposes.
The other instance that I've just told you about was a case where an employee was taken into custody for some role in in a theft that had taken place. But again, it was not here in the Capitol itself, I don't believe. But it's been a few years ago, so I'm not. I'd have to go back and check the records on that.
Thank you, Sheriff Ramirez.
I guess you know, the point here about having checks and balances, I guess that's the best way to describe it, in an organization where you do have criteria that is able to screen individuals that come into the workforce. We have a responsibility, particularly in government, to ensure that co-workers are going to be safe as we bring on new employees. And we recognize, and as an example, in this county, we have over 1,300 sex offenders, registered sex offenders, that particularly if we, and again, that's just one area, that if there's no screening mechanism where somebody could be brought into the workforce that could have access to children, that's, you know, a responsibility that we need to consider as we look at how we, you know, manage our respective organizations. I didn't want to lose sight of that, because without an adequate screening process, a background check, those kind of individuals or individuals that are wanted are going to be able to slide in, and we have a responsibility to protect our workforce.
And Chair Wilson, Commissioner Ramirez, there's a delicate balancing act that you're well aware of between public access and protecting the employees and members of the public who are here in the building. And I know that the Speaker and the President struggle with this all the time, because they want to encourage Oregonians to come to the Capitol to participate in the process, and they want to provide a safe environment. And it is a situation where certainly we could implement more strict guidelines on coming into the building, and we would be happy to do that. But it's a public relations issue. It's a political issue of how difficult do you want to make it. We had the opportunity, and Commissioner Garber was along to tour the Capitol in Washington, in Olympia, a couple of weeks ago, and they implemented metal detectors and had everyone coming into the building, including legislators, lobbyists, the members of the public, going through metal detectors. And they did that, and they ran the program for I think it was about a year. And then, because of the cost of it and because of the inconvenience, even though the inconvenience was relatively slight, they made a decision that it was no longer necessary. I know I visited the Capitol in Colorado a few years ago, where shortly after 9/11 they put in metal detectors and restricted access, and I believe they have now stopped that. It's an issue that I think at the time when there's an incident that drives people to respond, they'll take those actions, and then as we get further away from that incident, the memories of it fade, and at that point you start going, is it worth the expense? Is it worth the time? Is it worth that inconvenience factor of running people through that? We're wide open to doing that, but again, it's a decision that ultimately rests with the Legislative Administration Committee to make that call and say, yes, we want to implement that program.
For the record, Dave, could you tell us about the chain of command as far as security goes? You just made a reference to that, but could you elaborate on that for us?
Certainly. Under statute, the legislative administrator, myself, is responsible for the Capitol at the direction of the Legislative Administration Committee. For security, we contract with the Oregon State Police, which has an office in the ground floor of the building. There's a lieutenant who is based here, and a sergeant, and several troopers who work here on an ongoing basis, both providing security here in the Capitol and to the rest of the buildings on the Capitol Mall. That is managed by my facilities manager, Herb Colom. So if there is an incident, the lieutenant reports to Herb and or me, and it flows up to this point, and then we'll go and talk with the Speaker and President and other legislators as required to address any issues that may come up.
Could you tell us about the Legislative Administrative Committee?
Sure. LAC is established in statute, and it is co-chaired by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. There are three additional senators on the committee and four additional representatives on the committee. It meets on a periodic basis, typically during the interim. The other legislators who are generally appointed to the committee tend to be those in leadership positions. The Senate Majority Leader, the Senate Republican Leader, the House Majority Leader, the House Democratic Leader are all on the committee, and a couple of other members. And as I said, they meet on a periodic basis, typically during the interim, to make any broad policy decisions as it relates to management of the building.
So is it fair to say that they make recommendations to you to carry out, or do you, does it go the other direction?
It would be fair to say that they give, I make recommendations to them, they make the policy decisions, and then I implement whatever their decisions are.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Let me follow up on that point. Commissioner Wilhelm.
I have one other question,
Mr. Chair. They keep popping up here. I know, that, Dave, that we've done two or three different reviews of security in the building, and I guess I've had the pleasure of reading one of them at least. But what seems to be the area of emphasis in security these days, or even in these reports? Is it the threat of an individual coming in and causing mayhem in the building, or is it the threat of somebody taking a truckload of explosives down in the basement and touching it off? I suppose the answer is, well, we're worried about both, but what seems to be the thing that gets the highest priority, the highest risk, I guess? Where does it exist?
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Wilhelms, that's a nice segue into bullet number two, which is secure the underground parking garage. The parking garage is the area that in all of the audits that have been conducted has attracted the most attention. We have, you will recall that it wasn't very long ago that there was no roll-up gate at either the entrance or the exit. You could, anyone at any time other than late at night when we actually closed the gates, could drive into the underground parking. Following 9/11, we installed those gates, and we've restricted access to only people who are supposed to be here with the ID cards. But there are still issues related to the underground parking that are of concern. If an individual came into the building at this point, they could go down to the basement and go into the underground garage without having to have any kind of controlled access, and they could be waiting down there for a person. If they were planning to attack somebody or do something like that. We have been looking in just the last few weeks into installing card readers to limit access to that underground parking area so that only authorized people would be able to go down there. We're working with the company that has done our security work in the past to get an estimate from them on what it would take to do that. We do monitor the entrance and the exit. Concerns, physically we have a person watching cameras on those areas. It has been a concern has been raised about the time that the gates are open as cars come in or leave, but that is a safety issue, that you've got to have it open long enough for people to get in and out without feeling like they've got to race through and hit the gate in the process of driving in before it's fully opened or trying to hurry out coming out of the garage. But when those gates do open, our monitors pay very close attention to who is coming and going there. We had an incident just within the last two or three weeks where a person entered the underground parking garage and actually caused some concern for an employee who was parking down there. And we had a snafu, unfortunately, because our monitor saw the person or didn't see the person. For whatever reason, we did not notify the state police in a timely manner. Ultimately, we did get the state police on site, and they were able to intercept the person and talk with him and get him out of the underground parking area. But we had an error there. And those are going to happen as long as you've got as many access points as you have to the building. But the underground parking has been the area that has been raised frequently as a concern, and we are striving to monitor that very closely. And in fact, on a regular basis, the access monitor will notify Herb, will say a car has come in. What we instruct people to do when they come into the building, even if the gate is up, is they should pass their card in front of the card reader so that we know who's coming in. We'll have people who will follow, one person pulls up, passes the card, the gate goes up, they pull in the car behind them, without passing their card over the reader, will pull right in. We're now intercepting those cars. And if we recognize the car, we'll say, it's okay, we know it's somebody, and they are authorized to be down there. But if we don't, we'll actually send somebody, either state police or one of the facilities crew, out to check and see who is it who has come into the garage.
Hello.
Isn't there a... system, I think you mentioned this in some previous meeting, a system where you can actually set up at the gate where we'll just allow one vehicle through, and then a gate will come up from one of those tire punching systems will come up until somebody does pass their car through, and then it'll go down and allow the second car through. Isn't there a system like that that you were looking at?
I would defer to Herb.
Chair Wilson, for the record, Herb Cole, I'm Facility Services Manager. Chair Wilson, Chairman, Commissioner Wilhelms, there are systems like that. You have to bury those in the entryway and make them remote activated. They are very expensive systems. There are systems that exist, yes. The answer is yes to the question, but we have not looked into purchasing one of those at this point.
Further questions?
I have one.
Yes. Commissioner Ramirez.
The presence of security, as we've seen them over the years, is that something that's going to continue? And has that been a deterrent? Having that ground control limiting access for cars isn't going to stop an individual from walking in. That still is would be a challenge. So is that security presence going to continue on a year, throughout the year, or is it limited?
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Ramirez, thank you for that nice segue to the third bullet point, which is uniformed officers at entrances. I think that's related to your question. Following the knife incident on January 31st of last year, we worked with the state police to ensure that we would, at any time that the Senate or House is in session, have a uniformed officer in the lobby area outside the chambers. The person who came into the Senate chamber walked right up the grand, came in the front door, walked up the grand staircase, opened the back door to the Senate chamber and walked right in. We didn't intercept him prior to that because, he was another person coming into the building, did not display any suspicious behavior. At the time that he actually entered the chamber, the receptionist then used our internal alert system to notify the state police, and it was only once he got into the chamber that he pulled out the knife that he then threatened himself with during the standoff that went on there. We believe, anecdotally, that having uniformed officers is a great deterrent. I had numerous comments because following that incident, as I said, we had uniformed officers in the lobby areas whenever there was a floor session, and a number of people commented about how much more secure they felt just because of that uniformed presence. During a typical legislative session, we've got a number of uniformed officers in the building and a number of plainclothes officers in the building. The state police will bring in retirees, and normally there will be a state police officer or a retiree in every hearing room whenever there are hearings going on, monitoring what's taking place and actually intervening in any incident where somebody appears to be getting a little bit worked up and is maybe being detrimental to the process. So they're not at all hesitant about intervening. The bullet point about posting a uniformed officer at the entrance, I believe that would become cost prohibitive because the cost for a uniformed state police officer for a biennium is about $160,000. So you can see where if we were to post officers at each of the entrances, your bill goes up very quickly. And I'm not sure that having them at the entrances is as good as just having them throughout the building. And we did have a more active presence of state police following the incident at the start of the 05 session, where they were patrolling specific areas of the building on a more frequent basis.
Follow-up.
So I guess the question would be, in your opinion, do you think there's adequate staffing from OSP? And again, it isn't to draw on existing OSP personnel, but should consideration be given to ask the legislature to provide additional resources to give you more adequate staffing levels to assist OSP? Because we can't expect OSP to draw from throughout the state to staff the Capitol. It's a question and a recommendation that should go to the legislature of looking. And so my question is that something that we need to be considering? And are we at an adequate level of OSP staffing here at the Capitol?
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Ramirez, I don't believe we are. The number of officers that are available to OSP at any given time is very limited. If there is a major incident on I-5, they will pull people out of here to go out and deal with those issues. As I said, they're covering the entire Capitol Mall, so they're dealing with a number of buildings. And frankly, we would be happy to have more security presence in the building. But we recognize, too, the limitations that OSP is facing because of the budget cutbacks that have impacted them. And you know, they're in a difficult position of how do you take a trooper off of I-5 and put them at the Capitol where, you know, pretty rarely do we have any kind of incident that takes place. But when you consider the nature of what's going on here, would we like to have more security? Yes, we would.
Is it possible to contract with an agency other than Oregon State Police to beef up security here?
Yes.
Okay. Commissioner Wilhelms.
More of a comment than anything else. For the record, I'm getting tired of every time we want to do something to improve the legislative branch of government or state government, we talk about the cost. And I'm not picking on you. Because obviously you've got to be concerned about that. And then, you know, we find a reason not to do it because of the cost. Yet you go to other states. Every single state that I've traveled to and visited the state capitol has a better operation than my own state of Oregon, in my own opinion. And I'm just going to cite the state of Texas, for example. And there's no reason in the world why we couldn't do the same thing here in Oregon. These people are not just there for security. They're goodwill ambassadors. You pick a big, good-looking, 6'6", 280-pound cop with a great big star, and you put him by your front door, the guy with the knife probably is going to turn around and go the other way. And if he doesn't, he's going to get dealt with adequately inside the building. Why we can't do that in the state of Oregon is beyond me. Yes, budget is a consideration. But it makes no sense in a time when we're just almost asking for it in this building. And the second comment I'll make is it's disconcerting when you work in the building as a staffer, and many staffers do work after hours, and you have a need to consult with somebody for security purpose, whether it's because you locked yourself into a room that you can't get out of in this building, or whether it's because you feel threatened because of something that might be going on outside the building, and you call the state police, and this is not a slam at the state police, believe me, and you get a dispatcher outside the building who has never been in the Capitol building, who doesn't understand what it is you're talking about. I don't even know if they know the address. I just don't know. And I had that personal experience myself, and I am not picking on the dispatcher or the state police. I just think it is totally, totally wrong that we won't step up, spend whatever money it takes, do the right job in this building, at least for security. We got a lot of other things that I'm going to pontificate about in this committee that we ought to spend money on before we're through. But security certainly is one of them. And I'm frustrated by it all because I've watched it happen for years. We don't seem to be able to spend the money that we all know in our hearts we probably ought to spend. But, you know, maybe there are higher priorities in different people's minds, but it still is frustrating that we won't step up like the other states of the United States do.
Commissioner Ramirez.
I would concur with Commissioner Wilhelm's comments, and that's why we're here, Dave, to work with you and the legislature of how do we make this a better place for the public to be able to access, but also for the workforce to feel safe and secure. Let me give you an example. The Marion County Courthouse is two blocks from here, and we have one of the tightest security systems in access in the state of Oregon for county courthouses. And on a yearly basis, when we think about individuals that access this capital unchecked, at the Marion County Courthouse, we end up confiscating, seizing hundreds of knives, guns that had you not had an adequate screening process, they come into the courthouse, providing an issue of safety concerns for not only the public that accesses that, but also the staff that work there. So as we're moving down this path, we certainly want to work with you, and I concur. The funding issue, we need to address that. And we're not talking about just pouring millions of dollars. I think we can make some headway in addressing some of the security concerns as we move down this path. But I just wanted to comment on that without having an adequate screening process, it will create some concerns.
Commissioner Garber.
Yeah, I just I agree with my fellow commissioners. I was interested when we were in Olympia that the security people there really appreciated having the metal detectors, or at least that's what they said, and indicated that they would have kept doing it forever, but certain prominent individuals, I think is how they termed it, or you know, powerful legislators or whatever, said they didn't like the hassle of having to come through them. There didn't apparently, or wasn't apparently, a big outcry from the public from having to go through the checkpoints. And you know, you go anywhere in Washington D.C. or apparently the Marion County Courthouse or Disneyland or on an airplane, and you deal with that stuff all the time. And when you think about symbols and what might be a potential target, you know, the state capitol certainly has to rank right up there as an important symbol in Oregon. So I would just say that, you know, I'd be interested in knowing what the cost would be. You know, what is this number or dollar figure that's preventing us from maybe doing more than we're doing, and whether it's metal detectors or people looking through backpacks or, you know, that sort of thing. I'd just be curious in what some of those costs are.
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Garber, we worked up those numbers. Let me work with Herb to pull those back out and see, and we'll share those with the members of the committee. But it's been a couple of year or two since we've worked on that. But we can pull that out and share it with you.
Thank you,
Commissioner Ramirez.
Have you put together an overall besides the financial figures, recommendations, if supported, to implement for security here at the Capitol?
Commissioner Ramirez, that is a document that is we've been working on. It's not in a completed state right now. We've incorporated recommendations from your office and the other offices, and have kind of taken a piecemeal approach to it, if you will.
Okay.
Thank you. Dave, any further bullet points you wanted to address here before we...
One last item, Mr. Chair, and that would be, I think we've covered the locked doors issue and the public access to the building. Staff and member training on security issues is an area of tremendous concern to us because we don't believe we've done adequate training in the past on this. So as we are preparing for training and orientation for the 07 session, that is something that we are beefing up. We are including additional information in our emergency action plan, which is a printed document that is given to every employee in the building. So we have beefed up those efforts, and we will continue to do so as far as training and just making people aware of the security aspects within the building.
Thank you. Any further from the committee in the hearing phase of this? Okay, seeing none, we'll close the public hearing, and I'll open a work session on Proposal 026. All right, a word to the committee here, and this is, let this be a free-flowing conversation. We've got several points here that have captured your interest today, and I think it's fairly consistent through this committee. I have just numbered a couple of things here. You're concerned about background checks, possible use of a metal detector, certainly the need for more officers in the building, and staff and member training, and also parking garage issues. In that this committee is really not responsible for funding or recommending a specific funding amount, but only underscoring the need for these things in the opinion of the committee. Mm-hmm. We would have the option today, if you feel that time is of the essence, to actually put together a motion and make some recommendations as of right now, if you want to just have an open discussion about the feasibility of that. Let's do that. We want to be circumspect here, but on the other hand, we have the ability to be somewhat general in anything that we forward here, just simply recommending that appropriations be made in the process here to fund these things. Okay. Discussion. Commissioner Burns.
I think these are good ideas, and I agree with them. But I do want to say that as we move forward on the issue of security, that we need to do it in with a focus on the delicate balance of security and the openness and accessibility of government here in Oregon. Because I think that Commissioner Wilhelms made a good point about how we certainly do lack in security compared to other states, but we also have a completely different feel when you walk into our capital that you do at other states. And that's one of the things that folks that I speak to, that's one of the things they admire about Oregon government, and it's one of the keystones for folks' perspectives of government. They can walk into our capital and actually interact with the legislator. There's not this protective barrier that sends a clear message that government is distant from you or inaccessible. And I think that we need to go forward with a priority of balancing the security needs that we've identified and a maintaining of that sense of openness, because I think it is a really valuable component of Oregon government, which is unique, and we ought to try and preserve.
Thank you for the comment.
I agree with Commissioner Burns on public access. The items of under Proposal 026 that I personally hope make it into our recommendation would be 1, 2, 3, and 7. The 4, 5, and 6 are we've either done or have adequately discussed in the past, and I don't know what we would put in our recommendation other than the comments of similar to what Commissioner Burns has made for the record. Mm. But that's my personal comment. But I certainly would support a recommendation out of the committee today to pursue those items.
Commissioner Ramirez, let me poll you on this. Your thoughts about this today?
Well, I like the discussion and certainly the work that Dave and staff have put together in looking at the security concerns. You know, the legislature is going to have to take note of this, and the issue of access, as we historically have been known to provide unlimited access to the general public, needs to be weighed against making this a safe and secure location. Do we wait until another incident happens before we take a proactive effort in looking at that security aspect? And certainly the January 9th incident is an example of weapons that can come into the facility. The access pieces, I know, is an issue that the legislature struggles with, of not restricting access, but I think you can do it in a way that can be seamless. It's working in other states. What is our focus? Is it about just unlimited public access, or about protecting the workforce that's at the Capitol and the public that accesses the Capitol? So we need to look at that particular aspect of it.
Thank you. Commissioner Garber, do you have any thoughts on this for today especially?
Well, I guess I would have a question of Commissioner Ramirez when he talked about there are ways to do that. What, in your opinion, what are some ways that this can be accomplished without doing what Commissioner Burns fears, and that is, you know, making the Capitol seem less accessible, less friendly, less open to the public?
There's security equipment available that can provide you quick entry access into the Capitol. Citizens could walk through a ramp, and it would be a metal detector screening process, which gives you direct flow if, in fact, the metal detector within that screening process, and they also have what's described as facial recognition in that process. So individuals that have either been banned because of inappropriate or criminal activity within that location, the facial recognition would alert security personnel at that location. There's a conference coming up in April, International Security Conference, that has all of the security equipment, technology that could be incorporated into having a secure access into this facility. I'll be attending that next month, and I've given the information to this committee to consider if that is something as we look at making those recommendations of adequate equipment, technology that could help in that endeavor. So there are ways of putting that together. Another example would be kind of a turnstile similar to the State Street access that can be controlled with no manpower, but it's a key card access, gives you entry and exit without allowing anybody else to penetrate or exit. Mm-hmm. So it would be a secure entry exit point for authorized personnel. Mm-hmm. Again, not requiring any manpower. So there's technology and equipment out there that could provide easy access. So it isn't about making it more difficult, but it's out there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think what we ought to do today, as long as we're in work session, we should go ahead and ask staff to compose a motion that will include bullet point one, that is background checks, increased security in the underground garage, increased numbers of officers within the building, and increased staff and member training. And what our job here is to simply recommend to the legislative body that they fund these things, pure and simply, that they give serious consideration to the recommendation of this committee to meet these specific deficits, and in that process engage in a balance of friendly public access to the degree possible, you know, by this. As an overall statement, is that within the ballpark?
So moved.
Sheriff Ramirez.
If I may, would that include looking at secure access into the facility?
Define secure access.
Such as consideration to developing a security plan involving screening equipment and staffing, again, to be reviewed and considered in this motion?
I would think so. I left that out initially due to some of the cost issues Dave raised, but again, that I agree. We should go ahead and include that. As long as we're doing that, let the legislative body determine what they want to do with the expenses.
I concur, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if do we have anybody from legislative administration or the state police that are assigned to the Capitol going to the same conference that the sheriff is going to?
Not right now.
It would seem appropriate that that somebody on the inside ought to maybe go take a look on that.
Okay. Commissioner Ramirez.
If I may, I would make that recommendation that, and again, that Dave attend along with a representative from state police and someone from the legislative administrative committee So they have a good understanding of being able to assess and look at, you know, if it's cost prohibitive or it'll be something that they can support. This is an international security conference. Equipment, software, technology that you can imagine from across the world is going to be there to assist facilities such as the state capitol. So,
let me ask Marjorie, would this fit into this motion or should it be a separate recommendation? Because I'm not sure how timing is going to work out, because ultimately this would have to go through the full commission, and I'm not sure how the timing is going to work out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, are you talking about a motion regarding sending people to the conference? Or a motion for...
Yes,
yeah, I think
yes.
That was the
answer. I think that will probably be a separate motion from everything else.
Okay. Okay, let me ask you, Marjorie. We've asked a lot here on the fly, but how would this motion read?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think your motion could read something like that you're making a recommendation to the full commission that they encourage the Legislative Administration Committee to establish with regard to security checks or background checks, who, what, when security checks or background checks happen in terms of employees in the building. With regard to the underground garage, that they increase security in the underground garage, whether that be installing tire slashing,
take appropriate measures
to increase security in the garage, that's perfect. Increase the number of uniformed officers at entrances. And increase staff and member training regarding security issues in the building.
Yeah, I'd like to refine that part of the motion about increased officers at the entrance. I don't think we want to necessarily go that direction, but just an increased uniformed officer presence within the building.
Okay, good. And that we also address secure access, whether that is equipment or personnel. But we encourage the Legislative Administration Committee to work with the Legislative Assembly to fund these deficits that we've identified, but that they balance public access with security to the employees and public who are visiting the building.
Okay. I'm all right with that. Rest of the committee?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. For the sake of discussion, Dave, do you recall how many uniformed and non-uniformed officers they had present in Olympia during the session? Do you remember the number? The guy, the security guy up there gave us the number, and they had about four times as many people on the job in Olympia as we do in Salem during the legislative session. It was about, as I recall, it was four times as many.
I think it was eight on one side and 13 on the other side.
It was a significant number. And in addition to, in many states, the sergeant at arms plays a different role than here. And they had specific security personnel within the House and the Senate there. Plus, they did have Washington State patrol officers in the building as well. So it was a significantly larger number.
Yeah, just for the sake of discussion, Mr. Chairman, if that might be interesting. That was one of the things we observed when we were up there.
Thank you. All right, this is there's a motion, and would anyone like to make that motion?
I would.
All right, Commissioner Wilhelms.
I would second that.
Seconded by Sheriff Ramirez. Moved and seconded. Any further discussion within the subcommittee? All right, we'll take a vote, and Kelly, will you call roll, please?
Burns?
Yes.
Robert?
Yes.
Representative Speaker?
Excuse.
Sheriff Ramirez?
Yes.
Wilhelms?
Yes.
Sheriff Wilson?
Aye. All right, motion carries. And we'll close the work session. Well, hang on just for a second. Before I do that, I want to talk to Marjorie one more time here about the issue of the security conference and encouraging specific ones here to attend. Marjorie, I want to go back and address the security conference issue, and obviously anything we do is going to have to pass the full commission, and again, I'm not sure the timing of this, how it will ultimately work. Is this best done through simply a recommendation by this committee, just orally to
In fact, Mr. Chair, I think that might be your best option. When is the conference?
The conference is April 5, 6, and 7 mm-hmm. in Las Vegas, and it's the International Security Conference.
Okay. Mr. Chair, our next full commission meeting is planned for after that date.
Okay.
So I think it would probably be in your best interest to just verbally suggest to
okay.
people who need to go.
I think we've done that.
If I want to be careful here, but if it becomes a question of not sending somebody because of cost, that's not a problem? Okay.
Okay.
We have a budget in this commission, and I would be perfectly willing, as one of the co-chairs of the commission, to talk to the other co-chair to spend what money might be necessary to send a couple of people to that if you can't find it someplace else.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Sheriff Ramirez for bringing this forward, this conference, because I know that if he is invested in it as he is, he sees that as an important thing to do, and so recommendation made. So we'll close the work session on 026. Okay. And we'll now open a public hearing on proposals 012 and 013. Item number 012 is safety of electrical and water systems, and 13 is something called preventative maintenance. All right. Gentlemen, thank you. We have the same panel before us here.
Mr. Chair, I'm gonna defer to Herb. I'm just gonna say very quickly that our the safety of our systems, there's not an imminent threat at this point of the building burning down to an electrical fire or something along those lines. However, we have identified numerous concerns relating to electrical systems as far as the availability of enough power in specifically in the wings as legislators come in, and the power needs are much greater than they were virtually 30 or nearly 30 years ago when the wings were open, because now you're talking 2 and 3 computers and printers and fax machines and refrigerators and all of these items that are drawing on the electrical load or creating electrical load in the wings. And we have had instances where we have had insufficient power and we've had to reroute things to make it work. As far as the water system, I would encourage each of you to come to the Capitol on a Monday morning and go to the wings and turn on the water in one of the restrooms, and you will not be impressed. We pay a custodian to come in on Sunday evenings to flush the system because there is so much corrosion in the plumbing that to make it at least bearable on Monday mornings, we flush the system completely on Sunday evenings. I don't have samples of the water here today, but if I haven't shown those to you before, I'd be happy to bring them in the future. It's a very unattractive site. We've had it tested. It does not present an immediate health hazard, but it certainly is the reason why every office in this building has a water cooler, and you will find that the people who work in the building do not drink the tap water in the building. It's simply not something that people do.
Yeah, I can certainly verify that. Let me ask you about this proposal number 12 here. Do you really need anything from this committee on this, or is this obviously widely known, it's acknowledged, and we can just figure that the upgrading here is obviously part of a larger plan?
Mr. Chair, we need the enthusiastic endorsement of this committee and the full commission to proceed with the planning that has been done for an extensive renovation in the wings, which would correct the electrical problems, the plumbing problems. We've got computer cabling that is installed not to code. It is a hazard. If there was to be a fire, we would have toxic fumes. We have floor penetrations that have created what the architect calls a chimney effect, where the fire would spread rapidly from floor to floor. We put together a thorough proposal to renovate the wings. The renovations in the hearing rooms were the first phase of that. Funding was approved in the 01 session, and then the economy went in the tank, and we were not able to proceed. The cost is only going to go higher. It is significantly higher today than it was when we originally put together the plan 5 years ago. But the problems are not going to correct themselves, and we absolutely need the backing of this committee and the entire commission to impress upon the legislature the need to appropriate the funds, whether it be a general fund appropriation or funded through COPs. We're fine either way, but until we proceed on that, these conditions are just going to continue to get worse. Beyond that, there are significant things that need to be done in the old portion of the building, but because of the immediate issues in the wings, we'd like to address these and then move after that into the old portion of the building, where we're going to have to spend a significant amount of money making improvements there too.
Just for the information for the committee, our next subcommittee meeting will deal with the wings and possible renovation. And so that's what we will probably spend most of our next meeting on. All right. Questions?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chairman, you know, the when we were, citing the Olympia experience, and I don't want to Washingtonize or Californicate Oregon, either one. But there is such a stark contrast, and one of the things that hit me right between the eyes when we went up to Washington was we got in a conversation about the old building, because my concentration has been on the wings and how much work they need. But we all know that we went through an earthquake and we took care of the rotunda and the dome in this building. But we did not take care of the rest of the Capitol building, the old Capitol building, to wit. It became apparent, or it's a fact, that we have not secured the marble facing on the building, to the building, since the earthquake. Now, that was an eye-opener to me, maybe not anybody else, but I thought, holy mackerel, if there was anything you would want, it seems like you would want to get done, it would be to at least secure the marble facing on the building. And so we talked to the state of Washington folks about it. They just spent $119 million on their Capitol building. And, you know, we had a trouble and backed off from spending about 20, wasn't it, on ours. The price is going to be a lot higher than 20 now, and that was just for the wings. If you start building in these other things, the price keeps going up. But the point being that we have neglected some major items that for public safety need to be taken care of. Now, yes, probably we will talk about putting some new carpet to replace the green and orange carpet when we get into remodeling the wings. But the fact is that we need to do some major renovation and repairs to our Capitol complex here, be it the wings or the original building. And once again, there's no easy way to say, folks, we're going to have to spend some money. So I just think we ought to get ready for this discussion that we're going to have and recognize that we're not talking about walnut wainscoting so that the legislators can feel like they're in some sort of a palace. We're talking about doing some pretty basic stuff to this building that would bring it into the 21st century.
Thank you. Let me ask you for a moment about the current electrical work going on with the panel right now here in the main building. How's that going?
Mr. Chair, Commission, right now we have removed the walls and installed the new partitions where the equipment will be installed. We expect the equipment to be in town in about the next week to 10 days. We are still proceeding with our planned cutover for the last week of April. And at this point, it looks like we're on track for making that happen.
Okay. Will this have any effect on power supply to the wings, or is this strictly main building?
This is strictly the main part of the old building. As soon as you get to the crossover to the wings, that's a different power supply and actually come from a different direction. They're fed from State Street, and the old building is fed from Court Street.
Okay. Thank you. Before we depart, item number 12. Any questions from the subcommittee on that? Commissioner Ramirez.
I know we'll get into more detail in our work session, but Dave, as you've put this plan together on renovating the Capitol, is that broken into phases or components, such as the rotunda and then the wings? Is that what your plan has?
Chair Wilson, Commissioner Ramirez, yes. And in fact, the plan that was developed was the phase of doing the hearing rooms A through F and installing the infrastructure in these rooms so that when we move to the wings, the staff who are in the wings will actually move into these hearing rooms and we'll set up cubicles, and this will become office space during the 18 months that we've got to be out of the wings to do the work in the wings. And at the conclusion of that, we'd move back out of here, back into the wings. Once that's done, we would like to be, while that is being done, it would be our intention to be doing the architectural and engineering work to then move into the old portion of the building, and the subsequent interim or two interims later, move in and start the renovation work that needs to be done in the old portion of the building.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Wilhelms, did you have something?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think what we'll do is we will come back and revisit 12 or make it ultimately a part of a larger discussion that we have about the wings next time around. So I'll close a public hearing on item number 12, and I will open a public hearing on item number 13, preventive maintenance on the building. Dave, as you see this before us, I guess I'd get back to you again. What could this committee do, as far as you're concerned, to aid in the upkeep of this building by adopting some form of this, or is this simply something that we probably ought to include in the next discussion? I expect we can get a number of these and merge them into one issue. It's my intention.
I think that would be a good approach. I would like to say, just so that everyone knows this, all of the mechanical systems in the building, the HVAC, the fans, the motors, and all of that, they are on a regular preventative maintenance schedule as recommended by the manufacturers. And we conduct that maintenance religiously so that there are no dangers as it relates to that. There are a number of deferred maintenance projects that clearly we could take on. We've got a list that facilities has developed, and it's something that could be incorporated into a long-term plan for maintenance of the building.
Thank you. If I could have you make just one quick statement here before we move on, and that is about the issue of deferred maintenance. This is something we hear everywhere, from school districts to public bodies of all kinds, and that's always been haunted by deferred maintenance. I think in the tour that we made around the building here, we were shocked and amazed in some cases as we looked at the condition of some things, perhaps not the operating systems, but other more basic things. Just briefly, if you would, talk about the politics and economics of deferred maintenance. Why does that kind of thing typically happen in public bodies and perhaps specifically in this building?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think there's a concern, understandably so, it's a political concern, that any time the legislature appropriates money for the Capitol, it gets spun that they're spending money on themselves. It's the legislature being extravagant, spending money, you know, for frivolous things, when in fact the kind of maintenance things are the things that should be done to make this building an attractive place to make Oregonians proud of. There are just items that we're able to take one or two of them and tackle them through budget savings on occasion, but through the process of the last couple of sessions, we've gone through reductions in the legislative branch budget that have tremendously impacted our ability to even do that. So whereas 6 years ago we were able to maybe take a couple of items off the list and address them with our operating budget, we're not able to do that any longer because we've gone through reductions that have limited our ability to do that.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that perspective. I agree with a lot of that. Okay. Back to you then on this. I think this subcommittee is interested in helping with these two items, 12 and 13, but we also have the ability here to go back into work session and recommend no further action be taken on these specific items, recognizing that we will incorporate the thought behind these in the wing, possible wing renovation.
I think that would be a good approach.
Okay.
Good approach.
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Wilhelms.
Dave, do you still have that video that you guys put together here, I don't know, 3-4 years ago on deferred maintenance in the building?
Yes.
Is it still, how current would it be?
We'll take a look at it and see if it could be updated or if we can share it in its existing form.
Well, I think it would be good for the people that may not have seen that are on this subcommittee, because it was a very good documentation of just some pretty plain stuff in the building that needs to be done and the reasons why.
We'll do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Close the hearing then on item number 13, and what I'd like to do is open up, if I may, simultaneous work sessions on items 12 and 13. In subcommittee, what I'm going for here is just a motion to take no further action on these two specific items, and we will roll the theory behind these two into a larger recommendation later.
I'll move to
okay. Okay, so moved by Commissioner Garber.
Second.
Would that be akin to a motion to table, Mr. Chair?
No. Yeah.
No?
No.
Just want to...
Well, no further action.
Yeah, it's to take no further action, but rolled up into...
But that'll be part of the report that goes to the full commission.
Okay.
Take no further action because we are going to include it in a larger.
That is correct. Okay. Yes, that's it.
All right.
All right. And seconded by Commissioner Burns. Any further discussion here? Okay, seeing none. Kelly, call the roll, please.
Burns?
Yes.
Robert?
Aye.
Representative
Krieger? Excuse.
Senator
Ramirez?
Aye. Wilhelm?
Aye.
Chair Wilson?
Aye. And motion carries, and we'll close the work session on items 12 and 15. Okay. All right, we'll now open a public hearing on proposal 14. Yeah, let's just call it 14. We'll make them each. Let me ask you, should we do 14 alone, or should we just go ahead and do... Open it on 27 and 40 while we're at it.
I would open it on all of them.
Okay, let's just amend that, Kelly, to say we're opening a public hearing on items 14, 27, and 40, all three together. Mm-hmm. All right, lined up to testify. Ellen, let me mention what these items are for those people listening or watching. Proposal 14 before the commission is to determine if hearing rooms are adequately equipped for video and audio coverage. Proposal 27, review of technology, and Proposal 40, review distribution of video coverage of the legislature. All right. Wow. Yes. Thank you. And also by video, we have Mark Stanislavski, Southern Oregon Public TV. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate that. I think what we'll do here is, since we have quite a crowd, we'll let everyone take turns. You determine the order. Go ahead and introduce yourselves, if you would, please.
Chair, thank you very much. Again, for the record, I'm Dave Henderson, the Legislative Administrator. We're here today to talk about what is probably one of the most exciting projects that we've got going on that we think has the potential to impact every Oregonian, and in a positive way as far as allowing people throughout the state greater access to their government, whether it be the legislature, the executive branch, the judicial branch, or other entities and organizations that are doing things in their communities, like city clubs and things of that nature, that will allow people to participate greater in their government. We launched a project some time ago to look at video distribution of legislative content and other government content. Through that process, we have identified a idea that we believe is the best way to let Oregonians have access to their government. We've sought out partners to work with us in this process, and we've been very pleased that the public broadcasting people in Oregon, we have Steve Bass, who is the president of Oregon Public Broadcasting, with us. We have Mark Stanislavski here. Mark is the president of Southern Oregon Public Television. We have Phil Kiesling, who is the chairman of the board of the Oregon Public Affairs Network. And we have Bill Gross here with us, who is our media supervisor here at the legislature. Bill has been the project manager on this as we put together a way to generate information, and that really is the role of legislative media in this process of generating coverage of legislative hearings, Supreme Court hearings, coverage of board and commission hearings that take place that are executive branch board and commission hearings. We're partnering with OPB and SOPTV as the distributors of all of this information and really as co-producers of other programs that could be developed over time. The Oregon Public Affairs Network, we've worked with very closely for, I don't know, 6 years, something like that. They have been a tremendous asset to us in distributing our signal right now, and they are prepared to play a role of producing other content that is non-government content. And act as a co-producer as well as the public broadcasting community. And with that, I think everyone's prepared just to make a few comments, but we're just very excited to be here in this capacity today. So, Steve?
Thank you.
Good morning. I am a new Oregonian. I've been here a total of 2 months, so I will do the best that I can in staying with the Oregonian approach to these sorts of things. I should mention that I have held positions in other states, most recently in Tennessee and before that in Massachusetts, where I had considerable experience and oversight of state legislative coverage. In Tennessee, they have actually just gone live with televised state coverage via digital broadcasting in the Nashville area. And in Massachusetts, one of the units that I oversaw was the unit at WGBH that undertook the state legislative coverage. And we had a staff on site at the Capitol and distributed that via broadcast. We think there's a very interesting opportunity ahead for the state as OPB completes its transition to digital television. And some of you may know something about this, but there is a federal mandate that not just OPB, but of course Southern Oregon Public Television, both convert their broadcast facilities to digital, which is a mandate from the federal government. We are very close to meeting that mandate, at least as so far as our transmitters are concerned. We will have some other issues that we will have to deal with over the next few years with regard to translators, which are effectively little tiny television transmitters that are in some of the nooks and crannies in the most rural and remote areas of our state. But we have been working for a number of years on developing collaborative relationships with cable television operators and others. And public broadcasters nationwide now have a unique agreement with cable providers that is going to provide us access to additional cable channels. That is entirely unique compared to the commercial broadcast world, and we are now in the process of looking at what kind of services we can and will provide to the citizens of Oregon via these extra channels. These channels can be both broadcast over the air, so in the new digital mode, instead of just broadcasting a single channel of video and audio, we will have the opportunity to broadcast multiple channels. And in fact, right now on our digital television network, we have two such services that are up and running. But we are also looking to further expand that into other services to make use of this unique agreement we have with cable operators that will essentially make sure that these services are in as many homes as they possibly can be. There are a lot of things to be worked out in this area. I think this is the beginning of defining what this vision could be, that there are probably some other unique ways that we could be distributing content, but we are delighted to be looking at playing a role in this and trying to figure out how to do this on behalf of the citizens of Oregon.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Bass, quickly. Thank you. Just one briefly. It is going well, then, between yourself and cable companies at this point.
Yes. In fact, we have recently, in the last month, we launched a second channel on Comcast, which is the dominant cable operator in our part of the state, from kind of up and down the valley. And we have a second channel on the air now. We have not asked for carriage rights on any other channels, so we actually have some more capacity that will be due to us over the next few years.
Okay.
I don't want to speak for Southern Oregon because I think they have a different cable operator there, but I believe that they are on their way as well.
Okay, thank you. All right. You know, I might just ask Mark Stanislawski at this point, since we're kind of going that direction, if he would like to offer some testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with comments of our colleagues in at OPB as far as the opportunity this represents. It's an exciting opportunity to use this digital infrastructure that we are putting in and assembling. The rural communities are an important aspect of that, and we do have funding to convert our transmitters, but we're still seeking funding to complete the conversion of this project in the rural communities. And I think that's an attractive opportunity that gives us, in effect, an opportunity to reach the whole state live or simultaneously, I guess, more to the point, working with us. And as well, I would say, I would agree with everything Steve presented. I would say as well as this is a great fit for working with public broadcasting as well, because our audience, it's consistent with our brand and our position, working with public affairs and promoting civil discourse. So I think it offers a lot of opportunities on a lot of fronts if we can realize this.
Thank you. Mark, if I could follow up with you, what is the appetite for folks in Southern Oregon, especially for legislative information through the public TV realm?
Well, a lot. It would be consistent with what OPB's experience would be, in that public affairs is seen as one of our most important services. And at the moment, the only offerings we at least have in Southern Oregon tend to be more national in basis. But I think people are just as interested, and particularly given the remoteness of Southern Oregon, it's a way to connect the legislature down into what's going on here and provide improve citizen access. I believe in some cases the cable access channel here does provide that, but often it's a Federal Express video cassette or DVD that's played the next day. It's not that simultaneous interconnection and immediate access that is useful. It's often yesterday's news by the time it's broadcast on cable access here. And what we offer, and Steve made that point, is we have a very unique arrangement with the cable operators that we have access to channel capacity, and it would be a way to ensure that all Oregonians have equal access.
And you'll certainly be interested then, I presume, in getting more information from the legislature, more data, and be able to transmit that.
Absolutely. We've had some conversations back in January at Salem where we began to scope out what might be this service. So, yes, there's still a lot of planning still to be done on this, but I think there are enough pieces and seem to be interested in pursuing this that we're very excited by it down here in Southern Oregon.
Right. And one final question from me, and that is, if you could look into the crystal ball, what do you look at for a timeline to switch to digital for you?
So we're already digital right now. I should have probably mentioned that. We were on in 2003, the summer of 2003 here in the Rogue Valley, and then the fall of 2003 over in Klamath Falls, which where we operate two transmitters on either side of the Cascades. We have some 13 translators west of the Cascades, as you're familiar with the geography and terrain of Southern Oregon. It is very translator intensive because of the difficulty of getting broadcast signals around. That is still the remaining challenge for us, is to digitize those translators so that we can do, in effect, the last mile carriage. Now, we are on the air with a broadcast service, and we can do, and we have done multiple program streams in our broadcast channel. At the moment, though, the ability of individuals to convert to digital television receivers seems to be the impediment, and we believe that will be solved by 2009, when we're mandated to go all digital. As Steve mentioned earlier, we do operate a separate cable channel as well, but that also means we still have access to those four other channels in addition. So channel capacity via cable will not be a problem for delivery.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the subcommittee for Mr. Stanislavski? Yes. Commissioner Garber, please.
That's really a question for both. On this additional cable channel that you have now, is that, are you putting different content on there than you are on your regular channel?
Yes. We actually have two separate feeds on cable right now. One is a high-definition programming feed, which is 24 hours a day of both widescreen and high-definition programming that anybody that has one of the newer sets can fully enjoy. The other channel is a combination of lifestyle and how-to programming and some public affairs in prime time. So, for example, there's a repeat on that channel of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, Charlie Rose, some of those programs that allow people to watch them at a different time.
Is that true in Southern Oregon, too?
That's very similar in Southern Oregon, and in particular, the cable channel is on a neighborhood very adjacent to the existing broadcasters. One of our challenges is the digital system build out of cable in Southern Oregon is going more slowly than in the larger metropolitan areas.
Thank you. All right. Who's next?
Good morning. My name is Phil Kiesling. I'm vice president of an information technology services company called Hyperic in Beaverton, and in my role today, I'm talking to you as chair of the Oregon Public Affairs Network. You've already taught me something very important today. I will remember next time I'm in the Capitol not to drink the water.
You'll be okay today.
Okay. The Oregon Public Affairs Network started 6 years ago. It seems like truly was another era ago. And it is still around because of the vision and persistence of a number of people, but three in particular, Robin Olson, who's here today, who really started the idea, why shouldn't an Oregon have a version of C-SPAN? Simple question, but a very profound one. John Gradanus of the Wireless Instructional Network at Oregon State has been a visionary, as long with Kurt Pedersen, who is at Oregon State as well. OPAN currently reaches 400,000 households in the world of cable television, and every week for the last 3 years, we have been producing 10 hours of programming, original programming, each and every week. Much of it has been with the partnership with LAMS. It's not been gaveled to gavel exclusively. It's also been edited because of the time slots we have. But it's been other programming as well, from League of Women Voter Forums to city clubs to legislative hearings, court hearings, and the like. I want to stress three things in talking about OPAN. And I'm just delighted to be here because sometimes if you wait long enough, the world catches up. And this is a convergence in a really happy way, the opposite of a perfect storm, a perfect opportunity for this state to do something that isn't just important, but I would argue it is absolutely necessary. I thought it was really interesting, Representative Wilson, that you raised the question earlier about pipes and maintenance, and you asked why it's so tough. I think it's tough in no small part because too many of us think about government as them rather than government as us. The fundamental premise and vision of this whole effort, OPAN's beginning and the Oregon Channel and the partnerships that are represented here and more to come, is that people have an inherent right to see their government. Inherent right isn't a luxury, just like, you know, safe water isn't a luxury. And we have the capability to do that today at a tenth or less the cost than it would have cost us 7 years ago, and probably at a hundredth the cost that it would have cost us a generation ago. We are wired, the world of digital, quality video content, the content that is out there from so many sources, the partnerships here. This is, in a very simple, basic business-like term, a proposition that involves hundreds of thousands of dollars, not millions and not tens of millions. This is a matter of putting the pieces together and recognizing that people have a right to see their government. And not just their government at the state, when it's three branches, legislative, executive, and judicial, state and local government, hundreds and thousands of institutions, public affairs programming. To do it in real time, to do it gavel to gavel, to do it in produced programming, to do it in an interactive way. Being able to have Mark testify before a legislative committee today, I don't know where he has to be to get the linkage, but the day will come very soon where you can literally sit on a tractor in a field with a wireless computer and do the same thing. And I think that is a way to get people linked to their government. So OPAN has been, in a sense, a test bed, and we've been proud of that. We've actually raised a lot of money with partners, the cable industry, Comcast in particular, very early on, helped get us started. And then Oregon State and Kirk Patterson, John Gordanis, and others helped us refashion the model in a much more sensible business way. We, in a sense, reconceptualize ourselves as a distributor of content that others are producing, although we have capabilities to produce as well. Today we're talking about, in a sense, rearranging this and re-energizing this. We have the statewide distribution capabilities that OPB brings to the table to build on what we've done with PEG channels in the world of cable. The gavel-to-gavel coverage of not only legislative committees but other branches of government that's important, that Ledge Media has played a particularly great role in. But we have built also partnerships with lots of others, with city clubs, League of Voters, Business Council, lecture series and the like, that we can add to this mix. We are a 501c3 private foundation. We've, in a sense, wanted and have waited for reasons to gear up in a meaningful way to go back and approach the private foundation community that might be a little reluctant to give to a government institution and make the case for adding and enhancing. But the foundation has to be built. You have the chance to build the foundation now. And if there's one thing I want to stress, it is don't be narrow in the vision. This is a broad and incredibly exciting vision that involves not just the day-to-day activities of government entities, very important and very central, but also a public affairs capability to engage people in the debates and the challenges of the day in all sorts of ways. You need only look at TVW to the north or one of 20 other, and maybe it's close to 30 now, states that have done it. There's variations and various things to choose, but this is a vision and a great idea whose time has come. And I'm just really proud to and appreciate the leadership of everybody here at this table and many others to bring it to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Kiesling? Commissioner Wilhelms.
Was it OPAN that produces the filming of this commission, the public commission?
Yes. And it's part of the programming. We run 10 hours every week, and that's distributed through the public, the PEG channels in each of the communities. We've had to go community by community to get them to air it. But they've been terrific, and it potentially reaches 400,000 subscribers. I don't know how many fan letters you've been getting. But
I can tell you the anecdotal story. I was sitting in the hospital waiting to have a little surgery, and all of a sudden, boom, up comes the television set. And what's on there but the public commission on the
air?
So we had a big confab there with the nurses and the doctors.
Should have been part of the anesthesiology. You know, I'm familiar, obviously, with the term program director in my line of work. And when it comes to a 24/7 type Oregon Channel situation, who's the PD here? Who actually makes the programming choices?
I think that's exactly where the conversations end up going. It varies state to state. Steve, you probably have a better sense operationally of this. In our case, it is with OPAN, single private non-government entity. It's done by John Gordanis and his team down at Oregon University System about what gets on and what doesn't. Unfortunately, we have way more content than we have space to put on. I think Washington State does about 8 or even 10 hours a day of original programming. Then they repeat it.
I would just add that because we would be dealing with licensed airwaves that are entrusted to OPB, ultimately it would be OPB's responsibility to determine what was appropriate, since in a sense it's our neck in the noose. Mm-hmm. But that is also, that's not to say that I would perceive a tremendous amount of controversial programming decisions in this, but I think ultimately we would have to have a very heavy role in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the reason I ask is, legislative action as it is, you're going to have people worried about bias in programming, and they're going to be much quicker to vote if they feel it's even-handed and so forth, and you know how it is. Another question that I have, we probably know what a day on the Oregon Channel might look like on a March day in a session year. Let's pick another month. I don't know if there's a month that the legislature is not likely to meet anymore.
Pick this
month. But anyway, let's just pick another month where the legislature is not in session. What would a day look like there in programming versus a session day?
Well, I'll tell you what OPAN is running or considering running this month, certainly the Legislative Reform Commission, debates of candidates running for public office right now. We have a governor's election, for starters. We've got a City Club of Eugene had presentations. I think I was on one of them that's currently airing or will be soon. Willamette University has had lecture series of people coming in that we've run. The Oregon World Affairs Council. There is no shortage, we've discovered, to find content even when the legislature isn't in session. The Supreme Court is in session. Executive agencies. I think the LCDC right now is handling some pretty interesting issues that people may find more interesting than some of the legislative stuff.
That would... For junkies like myself, that would be really interesting stuff.
And,
seriously.
Mr. Chair, Bill Gross has done some extensive work on what is available in those times when the legislature is not in session. He's got a brief presentation on what is the Oregon Channel, and then Steve and Mark are going to talk a little bit about distribution.
Okay, great. Bill.
Again, for the record, Bill Gross, legislative media supervisor and project manager for this Oregon Channel. And I just want to add that we also plan to make a box set DVD copy of the commission available for you as well. So that could be a collector's item.
Keep the overhead low.
There you go. I think you've heard a flavor of the vision of the channel and a flavor of the content. Certainly from the legislature, we're looking at coverage of floor sessions, committee hearings, Capitol news conferences, and then certainly we want to approach the Supreme Court for coverage of Supreme Court hearings, appellate court hearings, state agency hearings, LCDC, Public Utility Commission, just to name a few, Department of Education hearings as well. And then we have also heard a flavor of the non-government events, such as debates, lectures, and speeches. And then we also want to work with our Oregon Public Broadcasting, Southern Oregon Public Broadcasting partners to get some ideas from them and contributions as well. To give you a snapshot of the project, the goal of the pilot program is we really want to provide a proof of concept of this Oregon Channel before we invest in a full build out of the channel. And we want to find things like, will viewers find this to be a valuable resource? What changes and improvements are needed, and if we want to invest in a permanent channel? And we want to plan some performance measures to evaluate the pilot. Some ideas include evaluating website visitors, viewer surveys, feedback from legislators and their staff, and certainly we'd encourage feedback from the commission members as well. We want to investigate detailed costs required for building out a permanent Oregon channel statewide, and we want to explore all content possibilities for the channel. We were up at TVW in Washington. One program they have that's very popular is a daily summary program of legislative activities. So we want to look at not just in the gavel-to-gavel realm, but other possibilities as well. And as has been mentioned here, we want to explore the best way to manage the channel. How do we manage all this content coming in the door, and how do we program it onto the airwaves? And finally, in this pilot, we want to culminate all of this into a business plan that provides the best roadmap to make this all possible. To give you a snapshot of our project timeline, this interim we'll be developing a partnership agreement. We'll be working on technical and infrastructure preparations, production and operational preparations, website construction, and business plan development. And right now, launch for the Oregon Channel pilot is set for opening day of session, which seems to be a natural, kind of like the Super Bowl of public affairs for Oregon. What happens at the end of the pilot project? The pilot channel could very well go off the air while we assess the pilot, see if funding is available to build out a permanent channel, and begin fully implementing a statewide Oregon channel. And I think Steve and Mark elaborated on some of the infrastructure challenges for making that happen. From there, I'll offer any questions.
Questions? Mr. Wilhelms.
I didn't hear you say a lot about cities and counties. I assume that you're not restricted. If you could film high-profile meetings in any city or county around, you could use those as filler or even the premier broadcast if you wanted to. But your choice. Is that right? You're not restricted.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Wilhelms, yes, for a longer-term build-out. I think for the pilot, we have to work with our available resources, which will probably be limited to what we're able to provide in legislative media, what Oregon Public Affairs Network can provide, as well as OPB and SOP TV. There may be opportunities to work with other partners in providing some content, but certainly for the long term, we want to look at how to gather content from all sources.
Okay. Mr. Wilhelms, what we've discovered, of course, there's issues about the production of content, and then there's the distribution of content. And in this world of digital cameras, you have to have certain standards, obviously, for broadcast. But OPAN has learned that there is few limits to places you can get good quality digital content that you can then distribute. And cities are a very important venue for public affairs. Again, I want to stress the broadness of this vision. And it's not just government entities that are part of this. It is private organizations that are contributing to public discussions and debates.
Mr. Garber.
Yeah, a couple of questions. One, you've talked about the web, and obviously people are getting their information from a variety of sources, and they sort of choose where they want to get it, and it's not always going to be cable or over the broadcast. So what would you see all of this programming being available on the web at some point, or just, you know, pieces of it? To kind of lead people to the television site.
Well, I don't see there would be any reason that the legislative part and OPAN wouldn't be available. If there were OPB programs on there might be rights issues that would not allow us to stream things. I do think we have to be careful about going too fast and too far in the direction of the web, because the deployment of broadband across the state of Oregon, I would bet, is extraordinarily spotty. That you would find that while broadband is readily available in the I-5 corridor, probably down in the major cities in southern Oregon, that as you move further east, the ability for people to receive, have enough of a broadband connection in order to stream video and do those kinds of applications would be pretty limited. Mm-hmm. Now, I'd also like to add one other thing that we are thinking about in terms of building out our technical infrastructure. These digital transmitters and translators that we are building are not really just for the distribution of television. Because it is digital, we can basically distribute anything to multiple platforms. So we are actually looking at the ability to stream and download content not just to TV sets but to computers and computer networks. So there may be some very interesting cutting-edge applications, particularly for rural parts of Oregon, that would allow us to, in a sense, serve this people who don't either have cable or broadband through some unique ways. And I think that the vision for this is not so much going to be limited by technology. It's going to be more limited by our own view of what we're trying to do and the funding model and management models that we put together to make it possible.
Okay, thanks. Actually, you answered both my questions in one swoop there. So thank you.
Commissioner Ramirez.
Mark, could you comment on this particular issue?
Yes, thank you for that opportunity. I would completely concur. Access to broadband is a significant issue in the rural communities that we serve down here. And the ability to build on the digital television platform could be, in effect, a great equalizer. Because not only will we be able to send information over the air to television receivers, but as Steve mentioned, the data delivery capacity, once we're in completely the digital domain, is just very exciting for a wide variety of services. We could even conceivably send additional video, website-like content that could go right to computers, which are already set with a very inexpensive tuner card. So it's very exciting, and I would agree that we are limited by some modest resources and investment in this, not the technology. It is possible to do all of this.
Thank you. Commissioner Wilhelm.
You're not literally getting into the telephone business, are you?
Well, our capabilities are only one way, so I presume that if you only had a need to listen or to talk and not do both at the same time, you'd probably be fine. But no, we're not trying to get in the telephone nor the common carrier business.
Thank you. Let me ask you about funding for a moment here. I have a feeling that this committee is very open to the Oregon Channel. Appreciate the concept. Where are you going with this, with or without the assent of this, ultimately, the commission?
Where we are right now, Mr. Chair, is that we believe that the pilot project, which is coverage of the 07 session, will cost about $150,000. That includes equipment that will need to be purchased, and it includes leasing fiber cable time to get the signal from here down to Medford. We are in the process right now of scouring our budget to see where we can find savings. We're looking at the assembly budget to see where there might be some savings there. We may, quite frankly, need some money. It may take a trip to the emergency board in June or September to say, you know, we've found 100 of the 150. We need 50,000 more to make it happen. We're hoping to find the money so that that's not necessary. But right now, that would be one request that we would make of your committee, is if a little additional funding is needed, if the commission could weigh in support of that, that would be helpful. Long term, OPB and SOPTV are looking at numbers of what it's going to take for the long term build out of what Steve described as the translators for the digital signal. And that's something that the legislature in the past has been supportive of public broadcasting and some of the early efforts on converting to digital. And clearly, if this is something where we're going to get legislative content and other government content and other non-government content that's that's a public affairs nature out to the citizens that we would obviously be coming to the legislature asking for support of that.
Thank you. Further questions? Commissioner Wilhelm.
Do we have any idea what the big picture cost would be of this to build out the translators?
It's a little hard to have a precise figure, but I will tell you that we at OPB have 42 translators in rural areas. Mark has, I think he said, 12. For a plug number at this point, we're really looking at $100,000 a piece or less, but it really depends on the siting. We will have to do further study to figure out, do we need all of them, and how do we do that? I would also say that both OPB and SOPTV are committed to providing a significant amount of in-kind support through the pilot stage of this, that we are not asking for any subsidization of costs related to the use of our signal or our engineering costs. I think, though, it is important to point out that OPB and SOPTV receive no state support at this point. And for OPB, and I think as well as in Southern Oregon, it's a real challenge for us to figure out how to maintain the service in the most rural areas of Oregon. So we're going to have to figure that one out while we're doing this pilot.
I would agree completely that funding rural service, if we're forced to look at it as a business model, is pretty challenging because the only thing we have to look at is membership support or local underwriting that may come from that community. But at the same time, it's also a tremendous opportunity that the state has to build on a platform that we are mandated to do and that can provide additional utility and use. So to take comments that Phil Keeson made earlier, it's a great opportunity to get a lot of bang for your buck.
And can I tell you, Chair Wilson, that since its inception, I think the Oregon Public Affairs Network has actually raised over $300,000 from private organizations. Wow. There's no specific legislative appropriation for anything like an Oregon channel. The lesson, as I take away from every other state that has done this, some more successfully than others, is that you cannot do it successfully without money coming from the legislature. However, it is not something that solely has to come from the legislature. The legislature has provided a foundation for this that allows other partnerships to emerge and to thrive. And, you know, in 2003, the Oregon legislature did pass a resolution in support of this concept. It was very nice. It was HAR 41, and people said some really nice things, and it was in support of what we're doing, particularly with the folks at Oregon Wind Network and OUS. It, of course, came with no money. It was a big help, but it is a partnership of money from various sources of content and of people helping distribute it as well as produce it. But I just wanted to underscore that the catalyst role that is needed by a legislature. And, you know, the breakthrough for me, and I will not confess to understand the technology and all that's required, but when we started this, we assumed we would need $2 million a year to successfully pull this off. And the model that we then field tested, I think successfully, it's still running, you can see it, is one, it's more like $300,000 to $400,000 a year operationally. Now, this partnership with OPB and LAMS and others, we're talking about in, you know, every part of the state, because that's absolutely right. It's that last mile, the last 20% may be the most challenging, but it's catching up and starting down that road now rather than waiting is, I think, really, really important. But thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any further testimony from anyone on this? All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. I just remind the subcommittee we are in public hearing on items 14, 27, and 40. What I would like to do is keep the public hearing open on 14, but I'd like to close the public hearing on 27 and 40. Now, I will open a work session on proposals 27 and 40. And, committee, let's have a discussion for just a moment here about this. Let me ask you, what are your thoughts on this, specifically? The Oregon Channel concept.
I'm totally supportive.
Okay.
So am I.
Okay.
I think it addresses numerous issues that are raised here, and so I think it's a great pilot project, and then we can see where it goes from there. But I think our recommendation should be positive.
Mm-hmm. If you need words to back up the totally supportive thing, is it's the very reason that the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature was formed was to deal with the image and the function of the legislature, both of which were perceived to be negative on the part of the public. Now, you can argue whether it is or it isn't, but that's the perception. It seems to me that part of the problem is the lack of factual information to the public. And it seems to me further that there's no better way these days to get the word out than to actually show the public real-time functioning of the process. And that's what this is about. And I for that reason, I'm totally supportive. I think it would go a long way towards spreading the real word to the public, good or bad, but it would spread the real word.
I agree. You know, when I look back on my time here in the legislature, there are instances, for better or for worse, that should have been seen at home, in the home districts of the legislators. I saw some things that bordered on outrageous on the floor that probably never got back home to the home district. And so I think for accountability, this makes a lot of sense. But strictly in an informational sense as to what really is happening here, the general flavor of the debate and so forth, I think that probably is the best reason to be behind this, you know, getting the word back home. Commissioner Ramirez.
I would concur with your comments, trying to, again, reinforce the credibility of the legislature, the support, reactions, concerns by the general public, having access statewide is going to be a critical piece. And I know government is working very diligently to address that and be responsive to the public, but this is moving us in that direction to make access to the public easier.
Thank you. Okay, I have crafted a motion here, and it would read something like this. Let me run this by you and see how you feel about it. I would make a motion that we recommend that the legislature contribute funding as needed for a 24/7 Oregon Channel pilot program during the 2007 legislative session to establish a proof of concept for distributing gavel-to-gavel unedited coverage of the legislature and other public affairs events on a dedicated television channel known as the Oregon Channel. That's what I have, and how does that sound to the rest of you?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Sounds great to me, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if the full time, I mean, does your motion sound to me like it contained direction that the priority coverage would be full time coverage of the Oregon Legislative Assembly?
That is what I would want the intent to be, sir.
Okay. Well, and I too, but I wonder if that matches up with what the OPAM people, for example, are looking at.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Wilhelms, I think that we all recognize that the bulk of the coverage during a session is going to be legislative coverage, and during the interim period there's going to be a significant amount of legislative coverage too. But certainly it's going to take other content to make to maximize the value of the Oregon Channel. So while I would say legislative coverage will dominate, certainly there will be significant coverage of executive branch, judicial branch, and other non-government, local government coverage as well.
Mr. Chair, could you reread the motion?
Sure.
Yes. Recommend that the legislature contribute funding as needed to a 24/7 Oregon Channel pilot program during the 2007 legislative session to establish a proof of concept for distributing gavel-to-gavel unedited coverage of the legislature and other public affairs events on a dedicated television channel known as the Oregon Channel. And I think we're establishing intent here that during the legislative session should get the preponderance of coverage. Okay, well, that is my motion.
Second.
Commissioner Wilhelm seconds. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Kelly, would you call the roll, please?
Burns?
Excuse.
Barber?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excuse.
Sheriff Romero?
Aye.
Wilhelm?
Aye.
Chair Wilson?
Oh, it's aye. And motion carries. And we will close the work session on Proposal 40 and 27. Now, committee, just before we take public testimony, if there is any, let's take a five-minute break. I think probably be a good idea to stretch, but it will be for 5 minutes only, and I'll gavel back in at 12 minutes after 11 o'clock by this clock.
Okay?
It will stand in recess. The Facilities Subcommittee of the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature will come back into order. And I remind everybody that currently we are in public hearing on proposal number 14, and that is to determine if hearing rooms are adequately equipped for video and audio coverage. So Bill and Rich, if you two would come forward. Thank you. After we complete this, we'll move to public testimony today, but just want to clip through this for just a moment if you'd give us an indication of where we stand. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Rich Inglis, Information Systems Manager for the Legislature, and we'd like to give you some information on what the hearing rooms look like around the building. And Bill has put together some a chart for you to look at, which kind of demonstrates at a glance what the hearing rooms look like in today. We have some ideas about how we think we should move forward as an organization, keeping the Oregon Channel in mind. I think that that our capabilities need to improve as we go down the road to get good coverage for the citizens of Oregon. So I'd like to just let Bill talk us through the hearing rooms, if we could.
Great, thank you.
Again, for the record, Bill Gross, the Legislative Media Supervisor. In putting this chart together, I wanted to make sure that I addressed the term coverage somewhat broadly, because we're not just talking about video and audio coverage, but we're also talking about coverage of presentation materials, coverage of telephone testimony, video conference testimony, and certainly how we record and archive all of that content together here in the hearing rooms. I don't really want to go through this chart in great detail, but I just thought I could show you a snapshot that shows that, yes, we do have live video and audio coverage in every location. However, as you can see, coverage is not necessarily consistent in every location, and technology and the tools available is not necessarily consistent in each room. So with that said, some of the reasons for making all hearing rooms consistent in coverage is obviously to improve the quality and consistency of coverage of hearings, information, making sure information is clearly seen and heard in all rooms, and also we certainly want to improve the ability to record and archive, search and retrieve video and audio recordings. Number one, we need to make sure we meet statutory requirements for making an audio recording, and number two, we have in the past proposed an option package to accomplish this through a comprehensive recording and archiving option package. Also, another reason is to improve efficiency of staff time. We certainly would like to eliminate the need to move camera equipment around the building or setting up and breaking down other temporary equipment such as projectors, conference phones, equipment of that nature. And certainly we'd like to minimize the need to move a committee to a better equipped room. We'd like to have all committees have the same tools before them to conduct their business. As we demonstrated before with tools like video conferencing, we'd like to improve the ability for people to participate in hearings. And as Rich mentioned, we'd like to have more content choices available for things like the Oregon Channel. So with that said, I'll open up to any questions you might have about this chart or any other specifics on hearing coverage.
Thank you. I appreciate the chart. Let me ask you, if you have an Achilles heel that really stands out here, what would it be among the hearing rooms? What's the biggest deficit that we face?
Number one, I would say the recording systems. Right now, we use analog audio cassette recorders to meet statutory requirements, provide an official record of all legislative hearings and floor sessions. Analog audio recordings don't last forever. State Archives has indicated that some of the older audio recordings are in jeopardy of being lost forever, if you will. We have some other recording systems. We do record on video DVD legislative events, but not all legislative events, and we don't keep them all permanently. We do have web audio recordings. However, that system, and Rich can probably provide a little more detail on that, that system is not, we don't consider that a official record either. So I think that is our Achilles heel. And also the recordings don't necessarily, they're not easily searchable. If you could imagine a five-hour hearing and trying to find one item in just a big, long recording, it's really difficult to access that information and shuttle through it. I think one of the items or suggestions in one of the proposals was to have indexed CD-like menu of content from our recordings of hearings, and that is possible. Some other states are doing it, but right now we don't have the ability to do that ourselves.
Commissioner Ramirez.
Thank you very much for putting this chart for us. You know, as we've had discussions with the larger commission and in this subgroup, the issue of access for the general public and the potential for interactive testimony through the video conferencing. And as I look at this chart here, we're looking at how do we provide an efficient environment of maximizing the legislative leadership in those, whether it's in, during the session or you know, when the legislature is not in session, of how do we maximize staff time in providing that support. And certainly technology has made you know, advancements in this area, particularly such as the video conferencing, which would assist Oregonians from not having to travel to the Capitol, that you could have regional remote sites where that could occur. And again, that creates and lends to how we use this process efficiently. And again, for the benefit not only of the legislature, but the general public. So thank you very much for putting this together. And I like the direction we're going. But again, the legislature is going to have to recognize that we've got to get the equipment and the infrastructure, you know, updated. And certainly the piece of the archiving, recording, you know, it's digital now. It isn't analog. And, you know, as we're moving down that path, we've got to recognize that. And that will be the message going back to the legislature as we continue working on this particular issue.
Further questions? Any additional comments? Commissioner Garber.
Yeah, just again, and I don't know if the hearing rooms we saw in Olympia were representative of all of them, but at least some of them had technology that was that we could sort of be jealous of, I think. I agree with Commissioner Ramirez that we ought to be keeping up.
Okay. I have, and I know we're still in the public hearing phase, but I do have a proposal here. I've got a motion, kind of a three-pronged motion here that I'm willing to discuss if we go to the next session here. Any final comments about this? I do appreciate the work, as Roel said. I appreciate the work on this. Very descriptive. Thank you. Okay. Well, with that said, we'll close the public hearing then on item number 14, and I will open a work session on item 14. Let me present to you what I have here in the form of a motion that's been crafted here. It is a three-pronged motion. Number one would provide funding for audio and video upgrades in each hearing room and chamber so that coverage capabilities are consistent in each location. The second prong here, providing funding for the recording and archiving budget option package so that recordings of legislative events can be indexed and easily searchable and archived with current technologies that are better suited for long-term storage. And then the third item is to provide an adequate maintenance and replacement budget for the legislature's audio and video systems to ensure equipment is kept up to date with current technology. All those sound good. There's only one wording, one bit of wording here I want to ask about, and that is on item number two. And it refers to a budget option package. I am not entirely sure what that is referring to, what we're getting at there. Could someone address that? Thank you, Dave.
Mr. Chair, Dave Henderson, Legislative Administrator. In the budgeting process that the state employs, you basically start with your existing budget, which becomes your base, and then any projects that you want to take on above and beyond that are presented as policy option packages. We have developed a policy option package for the recording and archiving project. I believe the dollar amount is around $500,000 that we will submit with our budget request, and it would include that, but it would be a separate item that would have to be approved or not in the budgeting process.
Thank you. Further questions for Dave? Okay. Commissioner Wilhelms.
Does that particular item include the conversion of the current analog files to digital files?
No, sir.
It's just a going forward?
Correct.
Is it possible to do that? I would think it is, to convert the old analog, and I guess you'd have, you're opening a Pandora's box there. How far back do you go? But
it is possible, and it's very time.
Yeah, it is.
Heavy time demand.
Yeah.
Well, surely you don't want to ignore the great speeches on the floor prior legislators.
from those prior, from 1979 and earlier, would that mean?
99 and 01. Okay. All right, thank you. Appreciate that. All right, we are in work session, and I have, I guess for lack of a better candidate, I've made that motion, so
it is there. I'll second that.
Okay, Commissioner Romero seconds that. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Kelly, would you call the roll, please? Excuse.
Aye.
Excuse.
Sheriff Romero?
Aye.
Wilhelm?
Aye.
Chair Wilson?
Votes aye. And just before I close that, again, this is for the citizens, and this whole process has been for the citizens to have better access to the government, and I think this package will certainly aid in that. It's a good idea, good concept. Okay, we will close the work session on item number 14. We have no public comment? Okay. Okay, I understand that we do not have public comment on anything that we're doing today. So we'll move ahead, and we will open a public hearing on proposals 114, 120, and 146. Pardon me?
Dave.
Okay. All right. Dave, we'll call you forward, and I think we'll direct you, first of all, Marjorie at least thinks we ought to send you to item proposal number 146 first.
Again, for the record, which would be under item number 120, Dave Henderson, Legislative Administrator. Improved cell coverage, cell phone coverage in the building. Good news and bad news. We believe we can do it. We don't know how much it will be and how long it would take to do it. We have compiled numbers for installing a wireless network in the Capitol, and while cell phone coverage is similar. It's different at the same time. We did not as we conducted the study on what it will cost to do the wiring for that. We did not do the same kind of study for cell phones. We can certainly do that and report back to a future meeting of the committee.
Okay, Dave, I'm not even savvy on this in the slightest. I understood very well what we were doing with the wireless, but what do you have to do to improve cell phone coverage?
Mr. Chair, like for the wireless network where you have to run wiring, you've got to run wiring and install antennas throughout the building. And that is to some extent of my knowledge of the system. If you want more information, Vicki Bremer, who is our expert in this area, is here, and I'm sure she'd be happy to respond to any questions.
I think I'd enjoy that. I'd like to know a little more about
it. I'm sure she would enjoy it, too.
It almost sounds like a duplication of at least the mechanics, but not the same service.
For the record, my name is Vicki Bremer. I supervise network operations for the legislature. I'm about a half a step ahead of Dave on this. It's possible to install a wireless system such as they have in the Capitol in Olympia so that the wireless picks up the cell phone signal and then transports it to cellular carriers. The wireless system that we studied, as Dave said, is not equipped to do that. We would need to conduct another study focused on both just a typical wireless purpose plus a cell phone. There's also a new technology. It's just on the horizon at this point called CellFi, where your cell phone would be intelligent enough to know if I'm in a part of a building where there's a wireless network and it's enabled for CellFi, then it talks over the wireless network and over the Internet, and that's how I get my phone coverage. But if I'm where there is no wireless, then it talks to a cellular tower, just as traditional cell phones do. But again, that technology is probably 4 or 5 years out until it's something that can be implemented.
Okay. Commissioner Wilhelms.
Don't the cell phone providers have an interest in this?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Wilhelms, they do, but they're just beginning to figure it out. So they're part of what needs to be developed. In addition to the handset that you need to do it, there are a couple prototypes out there, but they're not widely in use. Also, the cell phone providers need to figure out a service model that will be in their best interest and that will work, and they haven't done that yet.
Have we looked at other buildings that must have the same problem that we've got? I mean, it would seem that a cell phone provider would have an interest in a high traffic place, at least during a session. This is having their customers be able to have good access to their network. So I'm just wondering whether what they have done in other buildings and what their interest might be to the major providers, if any. And maybe they just say, step outside like everybody else. If that's the case, okay. But it seems like it's almost a service quality thing with them.
We could certainly check into that and report back.
Sure. Okay, any further questions? All right, I think what I'll do is close the public hearing on item 146, proposal 146, but we'll bring that back. And would you check on that just a little bit?
Yeah. We'd be happy.
I'd like to be able to do that without spending any money. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on proposal 146, and let's see. Let's take a look at 120 for just a moment. When speaking on the record, require people to state their name. We already do that as a matter of course. That is the way it is supposed to be done. In the heat of battle, now and then, it does not happen. Gary, let me defer to you for just a moment. This obviously wound up as a proposal before the commission here. I want to ask you why you think it wound up being on here. I would imagine it relates to those people who are listening to audio recordings, but is there any other reason?
Well, the only one that I can think of, Mr. Chairman, would, and I might defer to Marjorie, but I would think that the staff would very much like to be able to easily, when they're going through doing the minutes, for example, would like to be able to easily identify who it is rather than stop the tape, scratch their head, go down the list, make sure that
that, yeah, that's so-and-so. And it would. And as one who is guilty of not stating their name in these very meetings, it is something that you almost need to train yourself to do, but it is... It's not only courteous, it's more businesslike, and it should probably be done. I don't know that we need to make a recommendation other than deal with it by rule, maybe. Maybe the leadership ought to deal with it by rule, but I don't know what we would do other than write it in a report.
I mean, those of us who have been around long enough know this is really a nice idea. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I remember correctly, this did come from the public, and it had to do with those people who are listening over the Internet or listening to recorded meetings where they might not be familiar with who's at the dais or who's at the witness table, and especially if you have a panel where the panel introduces themselves at the beginning of the discussion. However, somewhere in the discussion, somebody pipes up and they don't identify themselves, or the chair doesn't acknowledge them by name, or a committee member doesn't ask a specific question of a member of a panel. And you're correct, like Commissioner Wilhelms has suggested, I'm sure that the committee staff, as they're transcribing the minutes or creating the tape log, it's easier for them to record who's speaking when they announce their name on the record. But there are some who can distinguish those voices.
What rule establishes this protocol now? Is it House and Senate rules, or just common legislative courtesy, or what?
Well, it's not in the House, Mr. Chairman. It's not, as far as I know, it's not in either the House or the Senate rules.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, but it may be that just in the... You know, when the committee chair starts there, as a former committee chair, you would know you would kind of have the power to kind of lay down the law in the beginning of the session to how to conduct the business.
Sure. Commissioner Ramirez?
This particular issue is going to have to blend in with technology upgrades as we continue moving down that path to be able to... acknowledge, document, and identify those individuals that are providing the testimony. And even though it should probably be considered as a legislative rule, we should make a recommendation to the legislature coming from this body as we're looking at improving the technology and access to the public. And I think we've heard the comments of concerns from the general public and staff. So I would say it would need to come as a recommendation from this from this body.
What would I want to seek some advice here from you. If we do go the way that Commissioner Ramirez has suggested, what might be the path to take on this? And Marjorie, I might pull you in on this as well. If we're going to ask that rule be established to require this, who are we appealing to? Leadership? House and Senate leadership?
Well, for House and Senate rules, and Gary, you can correct us, it would go through leadership and the members.
Mm-hmm.
One suggestion might be to encourage the chairs during training sessions and staff during training sessions to just be more conscious of this and continue to send notes to the chairs or provide training materials to the public about stating their name on the record when they speak. But I think it's also a training for committee members that as they're speaking, they need to identify themselves.
It could be included in probably more appropriately in committee rule than in House and Senate rule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that could be done, but still, they're anointed by the leadership ultimately. So, leadership could set the tone, and the committee chairs could adopt that as part of their committee rules.
I think what I'd like to do is we'll go ahead and revisit this another time. I'd like it to be a cogent motion with some forethought. It's a simple item, but requires a little more thought than I think we're able to do today. I'd like to talk to Judy and Ramona too a bit on this as I move ahead with it. So we'll revisit it again.
I like the idea. I think it's good.
We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Proposal 120. No, we are still open under 114, Utilize Internet Communications for the Legislative Process, Effective Electronic Communication. That really is kind of a broad scope there.
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I think this probably came from a public person who is just looking at using technology to effectively communicate either with constituents or in the legislative process itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Has this been rolled up in anything that we've done so far?
I think it's probably in everything that we've done so far. That's my own personal opinion.
Yeah. I really feel that, too. I'm almost thinking of taking no further action on this because this really is the direction that we're going in our communication reviews and everything else we're doing. Nothing's off the board here as far as improvement. And so any comments?
Sure.
Dave?
Mr. Chair, Dave Henderson. I would merely point out that on the legislative website right now, you can access all the measures that are introduced, all of the amendments that are introduced, the engrossed bills, the enrolled bills, the staff measure summaries, the fiscal statements, the revenue statements. So all of the relevant documents to the legislative process are available on our internet site right now.
Yeah, I feel there's an ongoing effort to do more of that.
In fact, we have several projects in mind that would do a better job of incorporating all of them just to make ease of access greater.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'm Rich Inglis, Information Systems Manager for the Legislature. I just wanted to add also that as we do technology projects, every new project that we do to automate a new system or a new function for the legislature, our default is to look at internet technologies first and see if that's appropriate in building that new system, because we understand that the public and people in the building like that way of going. It's the way that all systems are going. So we are heading in that direction at the moment, and that's our basis.
Good question. Commissioner Wilhelms.
At face value, the utilize internet communications for the legislative process, there's no question that we are utilizing the internet for all kinds of written stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What about audio? Could this question, does it make sense that the person that submitted this recommendation was looking for the ability to receive audio on the internet?
They can.
Audio
program? They can.
They can now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, we stream audio of all hearings and all floor sessions on our website, and we stream video in particular rooms. But there's audio of everything, and we archive the audio of all the meetings. So you can go back to the 01 mm-hmm. session and listen to, or 99, and access audio of any committee hearing or floor session.
I should have known that.
You're live right now on the web.
Well, I'd almost like to go back to the person who suggested this and say, maybe you just don't know what we're doing here.
Right, exactly. Commissioner Garber.
Yes, Commissioner Garber, for the record. I agree with the earlier statements. I think this is sort of entwined with everything that we're doing. And when we talked about, had the presentation on the cable access and the OPB and all that, they're going to incorporate a web component to that. When we talk about the hearing rooms, upgrading those, obviously, that improves the content of what goes out on the web. So I think it's redundant with some of the other things that we're talking about. And actually, if you go through the list of proposals, it comes up in many different places. So I think it's just sort of a duplicate of other things.
Okay. I agree. Okay, I sense that you do too. So we will close the public hearing on 114. We'll open a work session on 114. And if somebody would make a recommendation, make a motion that we take no further action.
So move.
Second.
Okay, got the motion and the second. Motion by Commissioner Wilhelm, second by Commissioner Ramirez. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, Kelly, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Excuse.
Robert?
Aye.
Representative
Friedrich? Excuse.
Sheriff Ramirez?
Aye.
Wilhelm?
Aye.
Chair Wilson?
Votes aye. And the motion carries, and we will close the work session on 114. And anything for the record here? I want to thank you all for your diligent attendance today. We covered some good ground today, and I want to thank you for that. Good day.
Thank you.
Further comment?
Again, this is Commissioner Ramirez. For the record, I want to thank Dave Henderson and his staff for putting all this information together. We've got a long road ahead of us, but I just wanted to compliment all of you for the work and information you've provided to us.
Great. Good. Thank you. All right, with nothing further, committee is adjourned.